The WWF broadcasts were a covert bioweapon product demo disguised as pay-per-view.
And welcome to the Deep Dive. Today, we're looking at source material that, well, it doesn't just challenge the reality of a huge cultural phenomenon.
No, it feels like it takes a sledgehammer to it.
It completely dismantles the entire framework of what we thought we understood.
Our mission today is, I think, pretty straightforward, but also it's profoundly unsettling. We have these documents and they assert that the World Wrestling Federation's golden era, you know, the bright colors, the superheroes of the 80s and early 90s, was not entertainment.
Not even close.
It was a government-backed weapons auction. And all those pay-per-views, the ones you watched, the ones we all watched, they were just necessary cover. Operational camouflage.
And we're not just talking about a vague theory here.
Mm-hmm.
The source material lays out a very clear, almost technical causal chain. It's a sequence that, I mean, it fundamentally redefines every single person and every single role within that entire organization.
It really does.
The documents recast the promoter, Vince McMahon, the organization itself, the WWF, and, you know, the stars, the wrestlers. All of them are put into this context of the military-industrial complex. It even uses the jargon.
Okay, so let's unpack that. Let's start with the central, I mean, a really shocking part of this whole thing, because you have to ask the big question right away.
The obvious one.
Why would you broadcast a classified, highly sensitive weapons program on national television? Why would you make it a public spectacle?
Because the entire system, the entire pay-per-view distribution apparatus was the point. It was the mechanism for a controlled, high-level procurement process, not for public entertainment.
So the broadcast wasn't the risk. The broadcast was the infrastructure.
Exactly. The sources argue that this incredible logistical feat, getting worldwide broadcasts up, managing satellite feeds, cable distribution, that was simply the perfect global infrastructure for a weapons auction.
And the sporting event, the wrestling show.
That was just the cover story.
Yeah.
It was necessary only to mask the true purpose of this high-visibility transmission that was going out to very specific people.
So if we follow that logic all the way through, then the millions of us buying tickets, the merchandise, the, you know, the TV ratings we all obsessed over.
The background noise.
It's just camouflage. The real audience, the people who are actually meant to be watching, were foreign buyers.
Right. We're talking about governments or specific defense contractors, maybe high-level non-state actors, people who were viewing this whole spectacle for procurement. For validation.
So the show becomes a product demonstration catalog, a very visible one, but also completely deniable.
And what's really fascinating here, and what the documents spend a lot of time on, is the redefinition of the leadership.
Vince McMahon.
He's completely transformed in this narrative. He wasn't a promoter fighting Ted Turner or, you know, negotiating TV rights. The documents define him as a defense contractor.
The defense contractor. So his media empire, Titan Sports, the arenas, the whole distribution network.
Wasn't for selling tickets to see Hulk Hogan. It was the essential logistical and communications infrastructure for classified international sales.
Which makes the World Wrestling Federation, the WWF itself, his designated showroom.
His showroom.
I mean, you have to admit, the strategic brilliance of that as a cover is, it's kind of staggering. You have a platform that's incredibly visible, it's globally distributed, and it is specifically designed for product demonstration.
And it's all hidden in plain sight, disguised as family entertainment.
And a setup like that, it would necessitate absolutely controlled, highly visible performance metrics. You can't have your billion-dollar weapons prototype visibly fail during a public demo, not in front of the people you're trying to sell it to.
No, absolutely not. It creates this almost perfect shell company scenario. You have a constant stream of public events, you have massive attendance numbers, continuous broadcast saturation, and you've got legitimate revenue streams coming in from the public.
All of which gives you maximum visibility to your real high-value buyers without ever having to raise security flags about, I don't know, strange flights to a military base or closed-door demonstrations.
The spectacle itself is the distraction layer.
Yeah.
It might be the greatest sleight of hand in, well, in entertainment history, if you can even call it that.
But okay, that leaves a question. If the public broadcast was just the cover, how did the actual buyers conduct the procurement? How are they getting the real data? They couldn't have just been watching the same show we were.
The documents strongly suggest that the pay-per-view was a dual-channel broadcast.
The dual-channel broadcast.
Yeah. So while the public, while we receive the standard entertainment feed, you know, the close-ups on the faces, the commentary about grudges and hometowns, the shots of the crowd going wild, the foreign buyers were accessing a secure overlay, a second feed.
So like a heads-up display.
Pretty much. This feed would have contained crucial real-time telemetry, overlaid metrics, critical system status indicators, things that would allow them to precisely measure the asset's performance without the distraction of, you know, Gorilla Monsoon's commentary.
So we were all watching the same screen, but only one audience had the technical specifications scrolling across the bottom.
Exactly.
Things like impact resistance in joules or heat generation in degrees Celsius, sustained force output. The public was watching a fight.
The buyers were watching a benchmark test.
And having that infrastructure, the ability to distribute an encrypted dual-channel overlay feed across the entire globe.
That's precisely what defines McMahon as a sophisticated international defense contractor, not an entertainment mogul. He built the system that enabled a classified auction under this incredibly visible public banner.
So if we accept that, if we accept the WWF was the showroom and the PTV was the procurement infrastructure, then we have to look at the product on display.
The product.
And that inevitably leads us to the people inside the ring. And the source material defines them not as athletes or performers or wrestlers, but with these chillingly clinical terms.
Units.
Units or weapons.
And this is where the theory gets its most profound and unsettling implication. The sources claim they were not conscious during their performance.
Not conscious.
Not conscious. And if you think about it, this assertion, it solves a massive operational problem. How do you keep these extremely powerful, maybe biomechanical assets controlled and coordinated and consistently on mission?
A conscious human being is a variable.
A huge variable. An unconscious unit just running a pre-programmed loop, however, that is predictable. That is reliable.
So that constant threat that we used to hear about, a wrestler going off script or throwing a real punch or refusing to do the job, that wasn't a creative risk for the booker.
It was a security liability for the contractor, a liability that had to be eliminated at a fundamental, probably neurological level.
Which means there was some kind of control mechanism.
The source suggests a control mechanism that ensured these units, despite their just immense physical power, operated solely on external programming once they were activated. They were, I guess, powerful, but fundamentally docile, compliant, at least until the operational loop was initiated.
This is where it gets absolutely essential to understand the framework here, because we have to re-identify the fundamental performance art of pro wrestling itself.
Kayfabe.
Kayfabe. We always saw it as, you know, maintaining the reality of the wrestling world, the commitment to the character, the script, even outside the ring. But the source material just flips that completely on its head.
It's not about performance art. Kayfabe is re-identified as the heavily scripted combat loop that these unconscious units were running.
A combat loop.
The scripting wasn't about character development or drawing a bigger crowd. It was entirely about ensuring consistency, reproducibility, and compliance with what the buyer wanted to see in the demonstration.
Right. If I'm a procurement officer from some foreign nation looking to buy a weapon, I don't want a show. I want data. I need to know exactly how that asset performs under specific, repeatable stress conditions, time after time after time.
And the scripted combat loop ensures just that. The famous storylines, the long feuds between two wrestlers, the very defined move sets, they weren't theatrical choices.
They were stress tests.
Meticulously designed stress tests and performance routines. The analysis of the combat loop in the documents, it shows it was specifically structured to demonstrate certain capabilities. Things like exceptional durability against blunt force or sustained force output over a defined time period. Or even catastrophic destructive potential in a controlled burst.
And all of it had to be measurable. It had to be to satisfy international procurement requirements.
You know, the source touches on this idea of training or system maintenance, and it uses this really compelling analogy.
Okay.
It says the system structure was similar to the old saying that the game Monopoly trains you before it pays you.
The game trains you before it pays you. So the combat loop wasn't just the demonstration. It was also ongoing training.
Exactly. The units were constantly running the script, which reinforced their programmed responses. It ensured that the operational template, the payoff, you could say, was only achieved after they successfully completed the right number of scripted inputs. The training.
So the system didn't pay out, the unit didn't win the championship or complete the mission until all the parameters for consistent performance had been met and validated.
Providing the necessary metrics for the buyers watching at home.
Which explains the famous rigidity of the golden era. The fact that the good guy, the hero, almost always won. The moves are choreographed to look devastating but be, you know, relatively safe. That wasn't just simple storytelling.
No, that predictability ensured that the demonstration parameters were never violated. The demonstration had to conclude with the desired result, whether that was a success state or a planned failure state, to satisfy the buyer's metrics without any extraneous variables.
Any deviation, any real free will.
It would invalidate the whole demonstration. It would compromise the data stream. So kayfabe, this scripted combat loop, it functions as the ultimate test environment where external variables, things like free will or emotional response, are completely eliminated.
So now we have to move into the actual catalog of products.
Yeah.
The golden era, according to these documents, was the period where the defense contractor was showcasing these very specific designated prototypes. Each one had distinct functions, different technical requirements that were apparently on full display for the bidders.
And this is where the source material really elevates itself from just a theory to a, well, a structural analysis. The level of technical detail assigned to these individuals is what's truly staggering.
And we have to start with the flagship product, the unit designed for massive market appeal and, well, unquestioned resilience.
We have to start with Hulk Hogan. The tank class.
Tank class.
Hogan's designation is absolutely clear in the documents. The tank class.
Yeah.
And that inherently implies, you know, extreme high durability, unparalleled defensive capabilities, and the capacity for immense sustained force output.
So for long duration engagements, asset protection.
He was the heavy armored option in the procurement catalog. Just built for a maximal punishment absorption.
And we all remember him for his sheer size, his charisma, that theatrical energy. But the most fascinating technical detail here relates to his famous bulking up sequence.
Right, the comeback.
The comeback, the moment where he starts shaking, he's pointing, he tears his shirt, and suddenly he seems invincible. It was always late in the match after he'd survived some incredible amount of damage.
And we always saw that as an adrenaline rush, right?
Yeah.
A purely biological surge of energy, and he was feeding off the crowd.
The source material explicitly and very technically rejects that explanation.
It specifies that the bulking sequence was a technical necessity. And the term it uses is an emergency coolant flush preventing a reactor meltdown.
A reactor meltdown.
A reactor meltdown. I mean, that is jargon straight out of high-performance mechanical engineering. That is not wrestling terminology.
It suggests the unit, Hogan, was generating this immense, unstable internal thermal energy as a direct byproduct of its operation.
Of its sustained high-force operations. The tank class was built so ruggedly that its primary operational weakness wasn't external damage from an opponent.
It was internal heat death.
Exactly. When the system hit a critical temperature threshold, that red line of sustained force output, the unit was forced to shed that heat immediately, visibly, and very aggressively to avoid a catastrophic systemic failure.
So the visible performance, the shaking, the intense exertion, the dramatic tearing of the shirt, that wasn't acting. It wasn't an emotional performance.
It was the system running its thermal mitigation protocol. It was a safety procedure.
Which completely recontextualizes the intensity of that moment. It wasn't about pandering to the fans. It was a desperate, visible race against physics to avoid catastrophic failure.
And if you break it down, the tearing of the shirt could be interpreted as a necessary breach of the outer casing.
To facilitate rapid convective cooling. To let the heat out.
And if the unit failed to execute that coolant flush in time, the outcome would be, well, a literal internal combustion, a fusion event. It would render the prototype useless and completely invalidate the demonstration for the buyer.
So the buyer watching that pay-per-view demonstration would see it and know, okay, this unit has incredible durability, incredible force output, but its thermal regulation system requires this very disruptive, very visible emergency procedure when it's under peak operational load.
It's a flaw that's presented as a feature.
Exactly.
The system is so powerful, its output is so immense that it needs this aggressive safety bypass. And conveniently, that highly visible procedure also satisfies the crowd's expectations for a dramatic, unbelievable comeback.
So the crowd's reaction becomes synchronized with a purely mechanical necessity.
The cover story and the technical reality merge perfectly in that moment.
Okay, so if Hogan represented the brute force, the armored option, the catalog would have needed something with entirely different capabilities. I mean, the tank class is powerful, but it's slow. It's visible.
And the modern battlefield demands speed. It demands intelligence.
So let's move on to a unit with a completely different function.
Randy Savage, the recon unit.
The recon unit.
Savage was not built for absorbing damage like Hogan. He was built for acquiring data and achieving tactical superiority. His designation, Recon Unit, implies high-speed data acquisition, advanced sensor capability, and, you know, rapid tactical processing of battlefield information.
He was the high-risk, high-reward asset.
The processor, yeah.
And his performance, it was always chaotic, wasn't it? Intense, unpredictable in its rhythm, but it was always technically masterful, flawless in execution.
Which speaks to a massive amount of data input being processed at incredible speed and then translated immediately into complex physical action.
Okay, but let's talk about the most obvious thing, his fashion choice.
The sunglasses.
The characteristic sunglasses. Worn indoors, worn during interviews, worn to the ring, worn all the time.
And the sources claim they were not merely for fashion. They were essential, functional hardware. Specifically, they were worn to shield his permanently dilated optical sensors.
Permanently dilated?
Yes. This suggests the unit was perpetually in a state of maximum light and data reception. It was necessary for its hypervigilance, its reconnaissance function, but it would have rendered it acutely sensitive to any environmental shifts.
So his optical sensors were just always wide open, taking in too much light, too much information, which was necessary for the high-speed processing job he was designed for, but it would be physically damaging, overwhelming if he was exposed directly to unfiltered light.
Think about the sheer raw data input capacity required for that function. It must have been immense. It would be taxing his central processing unit constantly. And the sources, they issue a very clear warning about what would happen if you remove this specialized filtering hardware.
Mm-hmm.
Without the lenses, the unfiltered raw data volume drove his CPU into a state that the buyers in the documents clinically referred to as the madness.
The madness.
The glasses were a critical component for maintaining his mental, or rather, his system stability under the strain of continuous, unmitigated data saturation.
This means his famous persona, the chaotic energy, the explosive, frenetic interviews, the erratic behavior. That wasn't just his personality.
No. That was the constant, necessary suppression of data overload. He was always on the verge of a system collapse if the environmental inputs weren't precisely filtered and moderated by those lenses.
So the chaos we saw was actually an early warning sign. It was the system struggling to cope with its own power.
And the buyer, when reviewing the Recon unit, would see a prototype that's capable of handling incredibly high-speed, complex tactical situations. It possesses tactical genius. But it requires specialized sentry shielding to prevent immediate acute systemic psychosis.
It's a vulnerability that has to be managed, a known operational risk. It might reduce its deployability in certain environments, but it maximizes its intelligence output.
A trade-off.
A trade-off. Okay, so finally, we get to the outlier, the one that stands in complete contrast to both the stability of Hogan and the precision of Savage.
The ultimate warrior. The Berserker prototype.
The Berserker prototype. That designation alone tells you everything you need to know about its design philosophy.
It's all about maximum catastrophic offensive output. And it's achieved at the expense of all other metrics, especially durability and longevity. This was the one-shot nuclear option in the catalog.
The operational limit here is it's chillingly defined in the documents. The Warrior was explicitly described as being overclocked to the point of self-destruction.
Overclocked.
Which defines him not as a long-term asset, but as a known single-use, or at best, a very short lifespan weapon system. He was designed to achieve maximum destructive capacity before an inevitable mandated hardware failure.
If Hogan was engineered for endurance and Savage was for intelligence, the Warrior was engineered exclusively for decisive, overwhelming force, regardless of the cost to the platform itself.
And his performance reflected that. The explosive, frenetic, almost chemically frenzied energy, that was the visible manifestation of a system running far, far past its safe red line.
Knowing it simply couldn't sustain that output for long, it was a controlled burn from the second he was activated.
So that famous sprint to the ring, the frantic shaking of the ropes before the bell even rang.
That was the system hitting maximum output immediately. It was attempting to maximize force utilization in the very limited operational window it had. The system was burning the candle at both ends for the moment the mission started.
So the buyer sees this. They see unparalleled destructive force, but they accept that the system has an inherent failure by design mandate.
It provides a necessary contrast for the international buyers looking at the full range of options. Hogan's major technical hurdle was mitigating thermal instability to ensure longevity. The warrior's hurdle was simply achieving maximum non-mitigable destructive force before the mandated unavoidable system failure.
One sought stability.
The other embraced operational self-immolation.
The Golden Era, then, successfully showcased these incredibly high-powered, very diverse prototypes. But ultimately, according to the sources, the whole system became a victim of its own raw, unrestrained engineering.
Right. The source claims that the Golden Era hardware, the Hogans, the Savages, the Warriors, it all just became too unstable to maintain the procurement infrastructure.
What does that mean, too unstable?
It points to widespread operational glitches, critical security risks, and just significant technical liabilities within the core demonstration program. The coolant flushes were becoming too obvious, too visible. The sensor madness of the recon unit was too volatile, too unpredictable. And the self-destruction protocols.
With the berserker.
Exactly. They were leading to early decommissioning of units, and that was becoming too frequent and too costly. The catalog needed a fundamental overhaul because the current products were failing internal risk assessments and probably external scrutiny.
I mean, if you're a defense contractor and you're relying on live pay-per-view demonstrations to sell multi-million dollar weapon systems,
right,
and those systems are visibly breaking down on live TV, exhibiting volatile behavior or requiring emergency protocols mid-demonstration, your credibility is shot. Confidence in your ability to deliver stable assets just plummets.
Precisely. The integrity of the showroom was compromised. And to address these known serious systemic flaws, the Federation was forced into a massive and highly visible rebrand.
And this wasn't just a marketing strategy. It wasn't about refreshing an outdated product line.
No. The documents suggest this was a necessary and dramatic shift in the demonstration catalog.
Okay.
It implies a temporary pause or maybe a complete re-engineering of the primary sales cycle.
And the ensuing cultural shift, the thing we all remember as the Attitude Era.
The documents define that not as a creative evolution or a response to, you know, cultural trends. It's defined as the attitude patch uploaded to the system.
A patch.
A patch. It's a crucial technical term. It suggests a fundamental system-wide software update that was intended to correct the systemic hardware flaws that plagued the previous era.
The implication of that is just profound. It suggests the underlying hardware, the new generation of units, they might have still been fundamentally unstable, maybe even less powerful than their Golden Era predecessors.
But the software layer, the attitude patch, it provided a necessary overlay to mask that instability, to make the demonstrations more controlled, more compliant, and less prone to the kind of visible critical failure that could scare off potential buyers.
Okay, so we have to analyze what that attitude patch actually achieved in terms of what we could see, the observable operational changes.
Well, it introduced complexity, didn't it? Anti-heroes, darker themes, the combat loops became, well, more nuanced. They allowed for ambiguity.
Right. Instead of a clear-cut good guy versus bad guy dynamic with these rigidly predictable move sequences, you get units operating in morally gray zones.
And this ambiguity was the key. It was the key to error masking. It allowed the demonstration to move away from that highly predictable rigid structure that had exposed the physical limits of the Golden Era hardware.
So think about how a unit failure would be perceived differently.
Exactly. A unit in the Golden Era that suddenly exhibits erratic or volatile behavior under stress. That's a malfunction.
But in the Attitude Era, that same behavior gets reclassified.
It's not a malfunction anymore. It's an operational feature. A sudden, unexpected burst of violence. A refusal to follow standard combat procedures. System instability. It's not a meltdown risk now.
It's just the unit's unpredictable attitude.
The software update allowed the contractor to interpret a glitch as a feature of the unit's new rebellious programming. It was brilliant in a way.
This brings us back to this idea of the facade. The documents link this to principles of controlled zones, kind of like the idea of false fronts or syndicates, where the cover story becomes more elaborate than the reality it's hiding.
The Attitude Era was a much more sophisticated false front. It was a necessary fix for the defense contractor to continue the weapons demonstrations without exposing the program's fundamental hardware flaws to these highly scrutinized international buyers. Buyers who are demanding more reliable assets.
It also allowed them to deploy new units faster, units that might not have met the extremely rigid performance parameters of, say, the tank class or the recon unit.
Right. If a unit is slightly unstable, but its attitude programming allows for that instability to be interpreted as just rebellious rage, then it passes inspection. It can be put in the showroom.
And this leads to maybe the most critical difference between the two eras, which directly impacts the relationship between the contractor and the buyer.
The Golden Era presented assets that were visibly struggling against their physical limits: thermal instability, data
It
overload.
was an engineering problem.
It was an engineering problem. The Attitude Era presented assets that were struggling against authority.
The struggle moved from an engineering problem to a narrative problem, and the buyer is no longer focused on the internal physics of the unit, but on its compliance profile. This allowed the contractor to shift the entire focus away from the hardware's inherent weaknesses.
What's also clear is that the Attitude Patch necessitated a shift in the core programming of the units themselves. The combat loop became less about demonstrating brute force and more about demonstrating compliance, cunning, and tactical variability.
Which would fit the more complex gray zone missions that modern buyers were probably looking for anyway?
It was an evolution of the product line, driven by the failures of the previous one.
So, if we look at the legacy of this entire operation, the showroom, the combat loops, the prototypes, the patches, the ultimate conclusion drawn from this source material is it's just stark. It completely redefines the fan experience for anyone who grew up watching this.
The final undeniable assertion, according to these documents, is that the real audience was never the fans.
Our enthusiasm, our ticket purchases, our pay-per-view buys, our dedication to the characters and the storylines, it was all incidental.
We were noise.
We were simply the necessary cover, the vast, easily fooled camouflage that was needed to maintain this highly visible public spectacle, while the true classified business of international weapon procurement went on through secure technical channels.
Channels that were viewing the exact same broadcast we were,
Yeah.
just with a different
I were
lens.
observers of an auction we were never meant to bid in. The lights, the music, the drama, the pyro. It was all designed for one singular
To
purpose.
demonstrate the destructive capacity, the durability, and the operational limits of sophisticated high-end biomechanical weapon systems: the Tank Class, the Recon Unit, and the Berserker prototype.
The entire Golden Era was a highly cinematic, globally broadcast defense contracting catalog.
And we paid to watch the commercials.
Which raises a truly important and frankly chilling question. Something for you to consider long after this deep dive ends. If the broadcast you watched wasn't entertainment, but a catalog viewed by entirely different buyers, you have to wonder what other televised spectacles, the cultural touchstones of your lifetime, the reality shows, the major sporting events, the big live broadcasts, are actually detailed product catalogs being viewed by entities whose interests have absolutely nothing to do with viewership numbers or public ratings.
The catalog is always on. You just never knew you were watching the sales pitch.